welcome to Addicted to Murder. This is Courtney, licensed professional counselor with over a decade of experience.
And this is Trisha, and my cords over here are in like a furs position.
Furs position.
F-U-R-Z.
Oh. I assume that means tangled up and crazy.
Yes, to be twisted and tangled.
That's how my cords always are.
Well, yeah, and I switch between the two laptops depending on what I'm doing, so I'm always just like doing shit with them, but I think they're okay. Everything seems to be working.
There's no weird buzzing sounds in your headphones?
I don't hear any buzzing sounds in my headphones. I'm the only one that wears headphones. Courtney doesn't, partially because we don't have a second pair, and I actually don't know if you even want to wear them if we did.
Not really.
Yeah. We only need one person to tell if it sounds shitey or not.
Exactly. So. And you're better at that.
I'm more anal about it.
That's why you're better at that.
There we go. Let's just call a spade a spade. Well, we're back with part three of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Woo!
And I have a question for Courtney, and I don't think I've asked it, but at this point, sometimes I don't know.
Okay.
So we'll recap it if I did. Have you ever had a broken bone or stitches?
I've never had a broken bone.
Mm-hmm.
I've sprained a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I have had stitches several times. I had stitches on my thumb when I was really little. Mm-hmm. After it got shut in a door frame.
Ouch.
Yep. And then I had stitches on my head when I was a kid when I fell out of a bunk bed and hit my head on a bookshelf.
TBI?
No.
No.
I mean, we'll if see. It did, then it made me
smart. You don't
have
smart. Any violent I behaviors?
I don't. No. And then I had stitches in my chin, on the bottom of my chin when I was in college and slipped on some ice.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Ow, so you like face planted it?
I like hit like with like my chin straight down onto the ice. It was not great.
Well, all of my stitches were my own stupid fault. I've had them twice in the same thing. That's the left palm.
Hmm.
One time was at work, but I was on my lunch break and I was trying to get the pit out of an avocado and I stabbed at the pit but missed.
Oh,
stabbed my hand. And then the second time where I still have nerve damage from, it actually took a long time before I could grab things properly. I was using a waiter's corkscrew to open a wine bottle and I hadn't had anything to drink. This wasn't a drunken thing. Mm. And I got, you know, it twisted all the way down. And when I went to pull the cork out, the neck of the bottle snapped in half in my hand.
Ouch.
Yeah. And cut the shit out of me and cut like something by my thumb. And it kind of sucked. Besides having the stitches, because at the time I was working at a bar on Friday nights and I couldn't grab like the mugs and I couldn't like pull on the taps with my left hand, which was the hand I used to do the anyways, because I couldn't feel
grip
it.
Things.
Yes, I couldn't grip it, but it's a lot better now, but I still have that weird tingly nerve feeling in my thumb. I don't think it's going to get better because it's been like 5 years.
Yeah, probably not then.
And I'm afraid of waiter's corkscrews now.
Fair.
Which I used to be really good at, but now I'm just like, and I think that was a freak occurrence.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
And it wasn't a cheap bottle of wine either, so I don't know, but it sucked.
It sounds like it sucked.
But no bones broken for me.
Yeah. So I probably should have gotten stitches two or three more times, but did not.
Fear of doctors?
No, just like, that's fine, I can take care of it kind of stuff. It's not that bad. But then it probably was that bad, and I just...
Do you have a scar?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes you have scars from stitches, but it's a lot, usually it's more minimal.
Mm-hmm.
I had to, when I was a medical assistant in primary care, I assisted putting stitches in a little boy's feet. He was like 3.
Aww.
And it was awful. The kid was so freaked out, even though we had gotten the numbing solution into his foot. So he couldn't feel anything, but he was just scared.
Yeah.
We ended up having to wrap him like a burrito.
No.
And then once he couldn't see what we were doing,
it was fine.
It was easy.
Mm-hmm.
But then the PA I was working with stuck me with the needle.
Oh, good.
So there's that.
That's another story.
There's that. Anyhow.
There's a question. Yeah, that's a good question.
Hopefully I didn't ask it before. All right, so part three, as I said, do you want to give us a recap on part one and two?
Sure. So in parts one and two, we learned all about little Jeffrey growing up in a family that may or may not have actually wanted him and mostly ignored him. So he lived out his fascination with dead things by collecting them and dissecting them and dissolving them in jars and all sorts of creepy stuff that made him kind of the weird kid when he was in elementary school. Then by the time he got to high school, he was still kind of the weird kid, but more for just like doing weird outlandish things to get attention, and being a full-blown alcoholic by the age of 15. So eventually his parents divorced and they both forgot about him basically and left him living alone in a house for 6 weeks. Before, you know, his dad returned, he tried to go to college, was drinking too much there, failed out of college, was sent off to the military.
Had his first murder.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The most important thing. So before his parents came back in those 6 weeks, he murdered his first victim, which was a
19-year-old.
A 19-year-old who was hitchhiking. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Stephen Hicks.
Thank you.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. You've got all these details in mind that I don't have. And he, you know, dissolved and dismembered the body and all sorts of things. Then he came back, went to college, failed out, went to the military, was...
He was discharged.
Discharged from the military because of his alcoholism. Yeah,
basically substance abuse discharge.
Yeah, and the horrific, racist and homophobic... Yeah. behaviors that he was displaying. And then he found his way after being discharged from the army down to Florida where we left him.
Okay. Yeah. And during that time, Jeffrey's stepmom, Sherry, tried to keep contact with Jeff after he was basically booted out from the army. I guess not so much Lionel. She encouraged him to move home. She may have just wanted to help him. I think she felt pretty bad about all he had gone through as a child, but unfortunately it was a too little too late for Jeff. But he did move back to Ohio in 1981, and he moved in with them. On October 7th of that year, Jeff went into Maxwell Lodge, which was inside the Rado in Bath Town. Oh, the Ramada. That's what that was supposed to be, in Bath Township, and was already drunk and combative when he got there. He would not leave when they told him to because he brought in his own bottle of booze. So the police were called. And when the cops showed up, he started a fight with them, which you should not do, and tried to kick one of them in the balls. He was put in the cop car when his behavior escalated further. And when they got to the cop shop, he was so drunk that he couldn't get out of the car on his own. He was charged with having an open container, resisting arrest, and conducting himself in a disorderly fashion. He was found guilty, fined, and had a suspended 10-day jail sentence. So, Courtney, his spiral into the criminal system has started, so like officially started. I guess they saw his explosive anger that we were associating with his BPD. What do you have to say?
I mean, it was really only a matter of time before his drunken behaviors got him in trouble. You know, between the racist and homophobic vitriol that he spewed while he was drunk, and probably some of that borderline personality disorder rage that was just in him, I'm honestly surprised he didn't get arrested sooner.
Right. Sherry and Lionel didn't know what to do with Jeff. Their attempts at rehab failed, and so they thought he might do better with his grandmother. She was the only one that Jeff really seemed to have a connection to. So he went to a suburb of Wisconsin. In later interviews, Jeff would claim that his grandmother was the only person he truly loved in his life. Perhaps it's because he felt that she truly loved him. She later told the papers, quote, "He had an awful lot of love for me. He never left without giving me a big hug. He always wanted to do things for me." When Jeff moved in, he went to church with her. He assisted in chores and tried to drink less. He also got a job at a local blood bank. He became a phlebotomist. He was laid off in 1982. During this time, Jeff started to go to the local gay bars and clubs on the south side of Milwaukee. Courtney, this was just a few months before his murdering impulses took over. Do you have any thoughts?
I think that Jeffrey felt secure and cared for by his grandmother. So there was kind of this honeymoon period of living with her while her love was enough to, you know, quell his fears of abandonment and to stabilize his mood for a little while. But those urges were likely always there. They never went away. But now he had a safe place to live. So then he was emboldened to start maybe exploring his sexuality more, going out to the bars, being a little bit more open about that. But then losing his job was likely a destabilizing factor for him. And it removed his routine and, you know, messed with his like sense of self and self-worth. So I think that all of that was going on at that time.
During this time, Milwaukee had a bit of a reputation for not protecting the black members of society. The city had already paid out millions of dollars in wrongful death suits where innocent black men were killed by the police. This attitude towards people of color would pave the way for Jeffrey to hunt within the population and get away with murder many times. I would assume the protections against the homosexual population were also subpar. So Jeffrey's chosen victim type was really on their own, as we'll soon see. On August 8th, 1982, at the Wisconsin State Fair, Dahmer was arrested again. This time it was for dropping his pants and exposing himself to a crowd of women and children. He was found guilty of disorderly conduct, paid a $50 fine, and went on his way. The book says that FBI profilers consider this kind of behavior indicative of a disorganized serial killer, which is how he will later be classified when his killings are uncovered. During most of 1983 and 1984, Jeff had no job and depended on his grandma for money. He did eventually get a job in 1985 at Ambrosia Chocolate Company. He worked the graveyard shift with Saturdays off, so he would go to the bars all evening before his shift, where he probably continued drinking. In 1986, Jeff got arrested again, this time for masturbating in a park in front of 12-year-old children. Boys is what they were. When he was arrested, he told the police that he had relieved himself in public at least five times in the past month. The police report reads, quote, "He doesn't know what changed him to make him suddenly start doing this, and that he knows he has a problem and wants to get help." Okay, Courtney, what do you think is going on with Jeff? We've really only seen this type of behavior, you know, in the public stuff with Randy Woodfield.
So I think we're seeing Jeffrey start to experiment with ways of satisfying his sexually violent urges. So exposing himself and masturbating in public are two ways of violating the psychological safety of others. And perhaps he hoped to find something that worked enough that he didn't need to follow through with his violent ideas. Of course, what he likely experienced was that these actions were exciting, but each time he needed to up the ante a little more to experience the thrill. So he may have been looking for a replacement, but in fact was accidentally kind of like fueling the fire.
Yeah, and getting a nice little paper trail of arrests along the way.
Right.
He would change his story so that it didn't seem like he was trying to do this stuff in front of minors. So he basically said something about being drunk, and therefore his charges were changed to a misdemeanor. He got 1 year of probation and was told to go to counseling. A pattern that we will see is that when Jeff is originally arrested and confesses to his crimes, they are most likely more truthful than what he alleges really happened later on. At first, he's ashamed, so he purges himself of what he did, but after he has time to think more, his self-preservation instinct comes in and he changes what he did to get a lesser punishment. Courtney, his immediate need to tell the truth may be linked to his BPD. What do you think?
I assume that you're referring to what's known as BPD guilt.
Yes.
So because of an unstable sense of self, right, people with BPD often feel guilt and shame or think of themselves as bad people who like deserve to be punished. So this very well might be contributing to Jeffrey's confessions. And it could also be that he often really is drunk when he's arrested, with lowered inhibitions and lowered impulse control. And then when he sobers up, he sees things a little bit differently.
His second murder victim was 25-year-old Stephen Tuomi, I'm sorry if I say that name wrong, in the summer of 1987. He picked him up at a club and took him to a hotel for drinks and to engage in sex. Most of the time, at least in the future, he would lure young men back to his place with money, usually asking them to take pictures for cash. Of course, Jeff was drunk on this particular occasion, and when he got Steve to the hotel, he slipped sedatives into his drink, and Stephen fell asleep soon after. Jeff told police that he did not remember killing the man, but when he awoke in the morning, the man was dead. Apparently, Stephen had bruises on his chest, but Jeff could not remember what he did to him to give him those bruises. After waking up, he went to the mall and bought a large suitcase. He stuffed the body into it and waited until his grandmother would be asleep. He got a cab and took it home. He dragged it down the side stairs to the basement apartment and waited until his grandma went to church the next morning. He again dismembered the body, separating everything from the torso. Then he cut those parts up into little pieces, kind of like what he did with the fish when he was younger. He filleted the flesh from the bones and ground them up as best he could also. Then he disposed of the bones and the tissue in the garbage. Courtney, do you think he really doesn't remember what happened? Jeffrey is definitely a mean-ass drunk.
I think it is possible that Jeffrey does not remember this murder. I mean, he was so forthcoming about his other murders that there would be no reason really for him to lie about this one in particular. And he was very intoxicated. And, you know, alcohol has a way of making people forget things. And yes, he is a very mean drunk.
So in the last episode, I think I said there were 13 years between murders. I was mistaken. There was 9, so sorry about that. But it was still quite a long period of time.
Yep, long cooling off.
Yeah. Jeffrey was not going unnoticed at the gay bars and bathhouses. He was getting a bad rap because he was drugging people's drinks. So he was doing that in public, too, when it was being noticed. He should have gotten his ass kicked. His next target was 14-year-old named James Doxeter. He hung out near the clubs at a bus stop. I guess lots of young teens hung out at this area. They may have been young runaways or prostitutes, or maybe they were just hanging out. James was an indigenous native with darker skin. Dahmer offered to pay him for photos if he would come back to his place. James obliged and left with Jeff. Jeff confessed to police that the two took a bus back to his grandmother's house and went to his basement apartment, where they had sex and then they had drinks. Jeffrey laced James's drink with sleeping potion. After he passed out, Dahmer strangled him until he passed away. He then undressed the body and noticed 2 scars on his chest that looked like cigarette burns, and he remembered that detail. So that detail would help identify him later on. He then dismembered him and melted down the skin in acid. When the flesh was soft, he pulled it off the bone. He cleaned the bones and he washed the acid, mushy flesh down the drain. He then began smashing the bones with a sledgehammer, and he put all of it that was left into the garbage. Courtney, I don't think we've seen another killer who drugged his victims before killing them. I mean, maybe a little bit of John Wayne Gacy. It seems like most of them get off watching them die, watching them struggle. Even Charles Cullen would sometimes, you know, make deaths painful and scary for his victims. Jeff, though, seemed to prefer that they pass out. No struggle, no fight. Do you think he was a coward?
I wouldn't necessarily say that Jeffrey was a coward, but I do think that he was lacking confidence. You know, incapacitating his victims before killing them upped the chances of being, for lack of a better word, successful. And we actually have seen some other killers who have used substances to incapacitate victims. Clifford Olson and Richard Rogers both used drinks laced with drugs to subdue their victims.
I can't remember if Gacy just used drinks and not drugs.
I think he drugged them too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That just came to my mind as I was saying that. I was like, mm-hmm. Well, maybe we have.
Yep. There's been a few.
Yeah. Well, Jeff didn't realize that he was not being as sneaky as he thought he was being. So Catherine, his grandmother, heard him bring men home and would hear strange thumps. And she especially could smell the foul odors left from the flesh that was still in the basement. Jeff couldn't smell the odor. Either he was used to it or his sense of smell faded with his alcohol addiction and cigarette habit. I don't know. But she eventually complained about it to Lionel. So on March 10th of 88, Jeff was released from his probation. After this, he met Richard Guerrero at the Phoenix Bar. Jeff offered him some money to return to his place to drink and watch videos. His grandmother's house, Jeff and Richard engaged in oral sex, and he was offered the laced cocktail. So he drank it, he fell unconscious, and Dahmer strangled him with a black leather strap. When he was alone in the house, he dismembered him, dissolved his flesh, and poured it down the drain. He pounded the bones into little pieces and took them out to the trash collector. Richard's family filed a missing persons report. He had been living with his parents at the time. So, all right, this one's a little bit different. A month later, Ernest Flowers had his run-in with Dahmer. He had been at the clubs that evening, and when he attempted to start his car, we're talking about Ernest, it wouldn't turn over. So he went to a payphone, because this was back before cell phones, to try to find a ride. Frustrated when no one answered his calls, he stepped out of the phone booth and Jeff came up to him, trying to start a conversation. Jeff told him that if he wanted to take a cab with him to his house, they could pick up Jeff's car. He could bring it back and give him a jump. Jeff hadn't driven because he thought he would be too drunk to drive home. Dahmer pushed him to go along with him, and I guess he was being really annoying, but eventually Ernest was like, okay, I have no other choice. Let's go do this. But he did make it clear that he was not interested in a sexual encounter with Jeff. When the cab dropped them off, it was not in front of the grandma's house, and Jeff started to act weird, and he was really evasive when Ernest asked where his house was. Jeff gave some answer about living with his grandma, so he wanted to get dropped off further away so it wouldn't wake her up. When they got to the house, Ernest didn't want to go in, but Jeff insisted that he needed to make some coffee because he was tired and, you know, he should just go in with him while he made the coffee. Ernest was starting to get the creeps at this point, and he did end up going in with him. But so Jeff started to make the coffee and tried to get Ernest to have coffee or some liquor. Ernest was adamant about needing to leave. Eventually, he gave in and said he'd have a cup of coffee with some cream and sugar. He did not ask for the roofie-like drugs that he was given, but he drank the coffee and he passed out. So, Courtney, Ernest must have a guardian angel looking out for him because Jeffrey's grandma had seen and heard him, and Jeff was worried about her being a witness. So even though he had gone through drugging him, he ended up putting him into a cab and sending him to the hospital. Ernest woke up in the hospital the next morning. He did have unexplained injuries. He had, quote, an abrasion-like rope burn along the side of my face, along the temple and cheekbone. They look like carpet burns. He was also missing all of his cash, a bracelet, and his neck chain. His underwear was on inside out. He had bruises on his neck, and white hair was in his pubic hair. Ernest was not willing to just let it go. He filed a police report for the missing items and for the drugging. The police did interview Dahmer after this report was filed, and he claimed he was drunk and didn't remember the name of Ernest Flowers. Maybe he had been with someone who was drinking and got sick and needed to go to the hospital, but he couldn't be certain. So the police did not end up filing any charges. I don't know if they didn't look at his past, you know, record at this point, or they just didn't care. Oh, Courtney, Ernest was also black.
Yeah, so you mentioned before, right, that Milwaukee and Wisconsin did not have a great history of protecting black people, especially probably black men, mm-hmm. And also gay men. And so here we have a gay black man claiming to have been drugged, sexually assaulted,
robbed,
all of these things. And, you know, it's 1988, and obviously I was not there. I was, 2 months old, I think, when this murder happened. But I would take a guess that, the police didn't even try.
Right. Well, Jeff's white, blonde.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows if he said racist things to the police to joke right. around with them.
Exactly. I'm guessing they just even talked to Jeffrey to make it look like they were doing following up, but had no intention of really.
I mean, you look at Jeffrey Dahmer, he doesn't look scary.
Not at all.
I mean, he's got the raper glasses, but that.
So did everyone in 1988.
Yeah, I'm like, at the time, those were just normal glasses.
Sorry.
So, yeah, he just looked like a blonde young man who probably was like, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I put some dude in the hospital when we was talking about.
Who lived with his grandma who went to church every Sunday.
Right, and had a job in the community and all that. So, and he wore hush puppy shoes. I only know that because that comes up later.
Yeah, so I don't think that, you know, Ernest was ever going to get justice.
Right. It's frustrating because, again, this could have stopped here.
Right.
Or at least been, you know, halted.
Exactly.
If he had been arrested and charged with this crime.
But, and, you know, if his basement apartment had been searched.
Looked into. Right. Because apparently it smelled, so there was stuff in there still.
Right.
Oh. So what Ernest went through wasn't all for nothing. He may very well have saved another young man's life. So he saw Jeffrey again about a year later out at the clubs. He asked Jeff if he remembered who he was, and Jeff said, quote, "I really don't remember who you are, but maybe we could go have a cup of coffee and talk about it." The nerve. Anyhow, Ernest lost it. He saw Jeff again that night talking to another man, and quote, "I was screaming and saying horrible things to him. Then a taxi pulled up and they both walked to the taxi cab and I started screaming, 'Don't go with him. He's crazy. Stay away from him.' I was just belligerent, I guess. The black guy looked at him, looked at me, looked at him again, and then he just walked away. Dahmer got in the taxi cab and left." Courtney, I think that coffee comment was definitely a smart-ass remark made by Jeffrey. He remembered him. It falls in line with some of the crap he pulled in high school and what he would pull later on in prison. What do you think?
I completely agree. Yeah, I think he absolutely knew who he was.
And that he served him coffee.
Yeah.
And got away with it.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, really lucky for this other guy that Ernest was there. Mm-hmm. Probably that guy never would have been seen or heard from again.
Right. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not surprised at what happened next. Catherine kicked Jeff out. She had it with the strange noises, the awful smells, him bringing home different men all the time. Maybe he felt abandoned again, but even he had to admit that he could use privacy for the shit he was doing. So he ended up moving into a cheap apartment on North 25th Street near Marquette University. The day after he moved into his new place, he met a 13-year-old Laotian boy named Southholm Synthansophone. I practiced that word, Synthansophone. To me, this next crime he commits is kind of the beginning of the end of Dahmer, but we're going to get into that next time. But Courtney, before we do stop for the day, where are you at with Jeffrey mentally? Any other observations you want to discuss?
So I think that we're at the point where, you know, Jeffrey is officially a serial killer now. Mm-hmm. And he's developed a pretty consistent MO mm-hmm. with picking someone up at a bar, drugging their drinks after he invites him home to take pictures or whatever. And then strangles them and then dissolves their bodies and chops them up.
Mm-hmm. And he has his victim type's pretty, it's their male. They tend to be darker skinned.
Yes.
The ages kind of vary. But
right.
They're not young children. They're
right.
Like 12, 13 and above.
Right. Who might appear older mm-hmm. Than they are.
Yeah.
And so I would say that while he had kind of this routine going at his grandma's house where he had to be careful, I think that probably was a protective factor for him. Mm-hmm. And now that he's off going to be living on his own, I think that protective factor is no longer there. And that's when things start to get messy.
Yeah. Thank goodness that they do. We're going to see some more stuff where we're like, WTF.
Right.
This case is full of them, of the yes. WTF moments.
Not just things that Dahmer did, but definitely things that the police did too.
Yeah. We'll get into that next week. Yeah, I guess that's all we got today.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Let's do a social media shout out. We haven't done it for a while.
Okay.
We don't really pay attention to our Twitter/X account.
So don't message us on there.
And TikTok, I don't know. I don't use it.
I don't either.
Instagram
and Facebook. Those are the places where you can really find us.
So for Facebook, it's at Addicted to Murder Podcast.
Addicted to M Podcast.
I thought that was just Instagram. Are they both now the same?
No, you just said Instagram, didn't you?
Oh, I thought I said Facebook. Okay.
Anyway.
Instagram is Addicted to M Podcast. Facebook right. is Addicted to Murder Podcast.
I think so.
Yeah. And our Gmail, if you have any questions or
comments or shout outs or stories.
Oh man. Sometimes we get some cool stories about people who have had experiences with, somehow with these killers. So that's at addicted to murder
podcast
at gmail.com.
Yes.
Jeez. pointless to me. I'm just probably confused the shit out of you guys. I'll put it in the show notes.
If you just Google Addicted to Murder podcast, you'll find all the things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, everyone stay safe and we will see you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye.